When they bade Rabat farewell, he told Taita dolefully, "We shall probably never meet again in this life, Magus. But it has been a great honour for me to be allowed to render you some small service. I am grateful for your willing assistance and cheerful company. Pharaoh himself will hear of it," Taita assured him. They struck out again southwards with Tolus as their guide, towards the hills shaped like a virgin's breasts and the fly country. Their time at Fort Adari had refreshed the men and animals, and they made good progress. Taita ordered that the hunters should keep the tails of the animal game they caught. He showed the men how to skin them, scrape flesh, salt them, then leave them to dry in the air. Meanwhile, they carved wood into handles and inserted them into the tubes of dried skin in the place of the bone they had removed. Finally, Taita brandished one of the fly switches and told them, "Soon you will be grateful for these. It is probably the only weapon that will discourage the fly." On the 20th morning after they had left Fort Adari, they made the customary early start on the day's trek. Then, at a little bit past noon, as Tolus had predicted, the twin nipples of the hills, like the breasts of a virgin, thrust above the horizon. "No further. Order the halt," Taita called to Meron. He had decided before they left Fort Adari that they would not follow Tolus's advice slavishly. He had already been dosing Windsmoke and Whirlwind with the cakes and hoped that the medicine would concentrate in their blood long before they suffered the first sting. On that last evening, before they entered the fly territory, he took Fen with him to the horse lines. When she saw them coming, Windsmoke wickered. Taita rubbed her forehead and scratched behind her ears, then fed her a Tolus cake. Fen did the same for Whirlwind. By now, both had developed a taste for the cakes and swallowed them with appetite. Tolus had been watching from the shadows. Now he approached Taita and greeted him diffidently. "So you are taking the grey mare and her foal with you?" he asked. "I could not bear to leave them behind," Taita replied. Tolus sighed. "I understand, Magus. Perhaps I would have done the same, for already I love them. I pray to Horus and Isis that they will survive." "Thank you, Tolus. We will all come together again, of that I am certain." Next morning they parted company. Tolus could guide them no further and turned back for Fort Adari. Nakontu was out on the point, breaking the trail, Meron and three squads marching behind him. Taita and Fen came next on Windsmoke and Whirlwind. The 18 salted horses followed in a loose herd. Shabako, with the fourth squad, brought up the rear. They camped that evening under the hills. While they ate their dinner by the fires, a pride of hunting lions began to roar on the dark plain beyond the hills, a menacing sound. Taita and Meron went to check the head ropes of the tethered horses, but the lions did not come closer, and gradually their roars receded, and the silence of the night settled over them. The next morning, while the column mustered, Taita and Fen fed the horses their Tolus cakes. Then they mounted and rode on between the twin hills. Taita had just relaxed into the rhythm of the march when suddenly he straightened and stared at Windsmoke's neck. A large, dark insect had appeared on her creamy hide, close to her mane. He cupped his right hand and waited for the insect to settle, extend its sharp black proboscis, and probe for the blood vessels beneath the mare's skin. The buried sting anchored it, so he was able to snatch it up in his cupped hands. It buzzed shrilly as it tried to escape, but he tightened his grip and crushed its head and body. Then he held it between two fingers and showed it to Fen. "This is a fly that the tribes call the tsetse. It is the first of many to come," he predicted. At the words, another fly settled on his neck and plunged its sting into the soft skin behind his ear. He winced and slapped at it. Although he caught it a hard blow, it shot away seemingly unharmed. "Get out your fly switches," Meron ordered, and soon they were all lashing at themselves and their mounts like religious flagellants, trying to drive off the stinging swarms. The following days were a torment, as the flies plagued them ceaselessly. They were at their worst during the heat of the day, but kept up the attack by the light of the moon and the stars, maddening men and horses alike. The tails of the horses lashed continuously against their flanks and hindquarters. They tossed their heads and twitched their skins as they tried to shake off the flies that crawled into their ears and eyes. The faces of the men swelled like some grotesque crimson fruit, and their eyes became slits in the puffy flesh. The backs of their necks were lumpy, and the itching was intolerable. With their fingernails they scratched raw the skin behind their ears. At night they built smudge fires of dried elephant dung and crouched, coughing and gasping in the acrid smoke to seek respite. But as soon as they moved away for a breath of fresh air, the flies arrowed in on them, driving their stings deep at the instant they landed. Their bodies were so tough that a hard blow with the palm of a hand hardly disturbed them. Even when they were knocked from their perch, they rebounded in the same movement, stinging again on some other exposed body part. The fly switches were the only effective weapon. They did not kill them, but the long tail hairs tangled legs and wings and held them so that they could be crushed between the fingers. "There is a limit to the range of these monsters," Taita encouraged the men. "Nkontu knows their habits well. He says that as suddenly as we came upon them, we will be free of them." Meron ordered forced marches and rode at the head of the column, setting a driving pace. Deprived of sleep and weakened by the venom that the flies pumped into their blood, the men swayed in their saddles. When a trooper collapsed, his comrades threw him over the back of his horse and rode on. Nkontu alone was inured to the insects. His skin remained smooth and glossy, unmarked by stings. He allowed the insects to suck themselves full of his blood so that they could not fly. Then he mocked them as he tore off their wings. "I have been stabbed by men. Leopards have bitten me, and lions clawed at me. Who are you to annoy me? Now you can walk home to hell." On the 10th day after they had left the hills, they rode out of the fly country. It happened so suddenly that they were taken unawares. At one moment they were cursing and flogging at the whirling insects, then 50 paces further on the silence of the forest was no longer disturbed by the vicious whine. Within a league of passing out of the tyranny, they came upon an isolated river pool. Meron took pity on the party. "Fall out," he roared. "The last one into the water is a simpering virgin." There was a rush of naked bodies. Then the forest rang with cries of relief and jubilation. When they emerged from the pool, Taita and Fenn ministered to everyone's swollen stings, smearing them with one of the Magus's salves. That night the laughter and banter around the campfires was unstinted. It was dark when Fenn knelt over Taita and shook him awake. "Come quickly, Taita. Something terrible is happening." She seized his hand and dragged him to the horse lines. "It's both of them," Fenn's voice cracked with distress. "Windsmoke and Whirlwind together." When they reached the lines, the colt was down, his body heaving to the urgent tempo of his breathing. Windsmoke stood over him, licking his head with long strokes of her tongue. She reeled weakly as she tried to keep her balance. Her coat was standing on end, and she was drenched with sweat. It dripped from her belly and ran down all four legs. "Call Shofar and his troops. Tell them to hurry. Then run and ask them to fill their largest pot with hot water and bring it to me." Taita's main concern was to get Whirlwind back on his feet and keep Windsmoke on hers. Once a horse was down, it had lost the will to fight and surrendered to the disease. Shofar and his men lifted Whirlwind and placed him on his feet. Then Taita sponged him with warm water. Fenn stood at his head, blowing softly into his nostrils, whispering encouragement and endearments, while she persuaded him to eat one tolus cake after another. As soon as he had bathed the colt, Taita turned to Windsmoke. "Be brave, my darling," he murmured, as he wiped her down with a wet linen rag. Meron helped him to dry her vigorously with fresh cloths, and then they spread Taita's tiger skin over her back. "You and I will defeat this thing together." He kept talking quietly to her and used the voice of power whenever he spoke her name. She cocked her ears to listen to him, splayed her legs and braced herself to keep her balance. "Buck hair, Windsmoke. Do not give in." He hand-fed her the tolus cakes, which he had dipped in honey. Even in her distress, she could not resist this delicacy. Then he persuaded her to swallow a bowl of his special remedy for fever, yellow strangler, and equine distemper. He and Fenn joined hands to invoke the protection of Horus, in his form as the god of horses. Merrin and his men joined in the prayers and continued to chant them for the rest of the night. By morning, Windsmoke and her colt were still standing, but their heads were hanging, and they would no longer take the cakes. They were, however, consumed by thirst and drank eagerly from the pots of clean water that Fenn and Taita held for them. Just before noon, Windsmoke raised her head and whickered to her colt, then staggered across to him and nuzzled his shoulder. He raised his head to look at her. "He has lifted his head," one man said excitedly. "She stands more firmly," another observed. "She is fighting for herself and for her foe. She has stopped sweating. The fever is breaking." That evening, Windsmoke ate 5 more Tolus cakes with honey. The next morning, she followed Taita down into the riverbed and rolled in the white sand. She had always favoured a particular variety of soft grass with fluffy pink seed heads that grew on the banks of the Nile, so Taita and Fenn scythed bundles of it and sorted from it the choicest stalks. On the fourth day, both Windsmoke and Whirlwind filled their empty bellies with it. "They are out of danger," Taita pronounced, and Fenn hugged Whirlwind, then wept as though her heart had broken and would never mend. Despite the Tolus cakes, many other horses showed symptoms of the disease. 12 died, but Merrin replaced them from the small herd of salted animals. Some men were also suffering from the effects of the fly venom. They were racked with enervating headaches, and every joint in their bodies was so stiff that they could hardly walk. It was many more days before animals and men had recovered enough to resume the march. Even then, Taita and Fenn would not burden Windsmoke and Whirlwind with their weight, but rode spare horses and led them on their halter ropes. Merrin reduced the length and pace of his daily marches to allow all to recover completely. Then, over the days that followed, he increased the speed until they were moving briskly once more. For 200 leagues beyond the flies, the land was devoid of human habitation. Then they encountered a small village of itinerant fishermen. The inhabitants fled as soon as the column of horsemen appeared. The shock of seeing these pale-skinned men with their strange bronze weapons riding on strange hornless cattle was too much for them. Taita examined their fish-smoking racks and found them almost empty. The Nile no longer provided the village with her bounty. Clearly the fishermen were starving. On the floodplains along the riverbank, herds of large, robust antelope with scimitar horns and white patches around their eyes were feeding. The males were black, the females dark red. Merrin sent out 5 of his mounted archers. The antelope seemed curious about the horses and came to meet them. The first volley of arrows brought down 4, and the next as many again. They laid out the carcasses on the outskirts of the village as a peace offering, then settled down to wait. The starving villagers could not long resist and crept forward cautiously, ready to flee again at the first sign of aggression from the strangers. Once they had butchered the carcasses and had the meat grilling on 12 smoky fires, Nokontu went forward to hail them. Their spokesman was a venerable greybeard who replied in a squeaky treble. Nokontu came back to report to Taita. "These people are related to the Utaza. Their languages are so similar that we understand each other well." By now the villagers were so emboldened that they came trooping back to examine the men, their weapons, and horses. The unmarried girls wore only a string of beads round their waists and almost immediately established friendships with the troopers who had no Shilluk camp followers. The married women brought calabashes of sour native beer to Taita, Merrin, and the captains, while the elder, whose name was Potu, sat proudly beside Taita and readily answered the questions Nokontu put to him. "I know the Southlands well," he boasted. "My father and his father before him lived on the Great Lakes, which were full of fish, some so large it needed 4 men to lift them. Their girth was thus..." He made a circle with his skinny old arms. "And their length was thus." He jumped up and drew a line with his big toe in the dust, then took four full paces and drew a second line, from there to there. "Fishermen are the same everywhere," Taita remarked, but he made an appropriate sound of amazement. Poto seemed neglected by his tribe and for once had the attention of all. He was enjoying the company of his new friends. "Why did your tribe leave such good fishing grounds?" Taita asked. "Another, stronger and more numerous people came from the east, and we could not resist them. They drove us northwards along the river to this place." He looked downcast for a moment, then brightened again. "When I was initiated and circumcised, my father took me to the great waterfall that is the birthplace of this, our river." He indicated the Nile on whose banks they sat. "The waterfall is called Tungula Madzi, the waters that thunder." "Why such an unusual name?" "The roar of the falling waters and the mighty rocks they bring crashing down can be heard from a distance of 2 days' march. The spray stands above the hills like a silver cloud in the sky." "You have looked upon such a sight as this?" Taita asked, and turned his inner eye upon the ancient. "With these very eyes," Porto cried. His aura burnt brightly, like the flame of an oil lamp before it dies from lack of fuel. He was telling the truth. "You believe that this is the birthplace of the river?" Taita's pulse raced with excitement. "On the ghost of my father, the falls are where the river rises." "What lies above and beyond them?" "Water," said Putu flatly. "Nothing but water. Water to the ends of the world." "You saw no land beyond the falls?" "Nothing but water." "You did not see a burning mountain that sends a cloud of smoke into the sky?" "Nothing," said Poto. "Nothing but water." "Will you lead us to this waterfall?" Taita asked. When Nakontu translated the question to him, Poto looked alarmed. "I can never return. The people thereabouts are my enemies, and they will kill me and eat me. I cannot follow the river, because, as you can see, the river is cursed and dying." "I will make you a gift of a full bag of glass beads if you come with us," Taita promised. "You will be the richest man in all your tribe." Porto did not hesitate. He had turned the colour of ashes and was trembling with terror. "No, never. Not for 100 bags of beads. If they eat me, my soul will never pass through the flames. It will become a hyena and wander for all time in the night, eating rotting carcasses and offal." He made as if to jump up and run. But Taita restrained him with a gentle touch, then exerted his influence to calm and reassure him. He let him drink 2 large swallows of beer before he spoke to him again. "Is there another who will guide us?" Poto shook his head vigorously. "They are all afraid, even more than I am." They sat in silence for a while. Then Poto began to fidget and shuffle his feet. Taita waited patiently for him to reach some difficult decision. At last he coughed and spat a large clot of yellow mucus into the dust. "Perhaps there is somebody," he ventured. "But no, he must be dead. He was an old man when last I saw him, and that was long ago. Even then he was older than you, revered elder." He bobbed his head respectfully at Taita. "He is among the last of our people who remain from the time that we were a tribe of consequence." "Who is he? Where will I find him?" Taita asked. "His name is Kalulu. I will show you where to find him." Again, Poto began to draw with his toe in the dust. "If you follow the great river, which is dying, you will come at last to where it meets one of the many lakes. This is a mighty stretch of water. We call it Simliki Nyanzu." He drew it as an elliptical, flattened circle. "Is it here that we will find the waterfall that is the birthplace of the river?" Taita demanded. "No. The river cuts through the lake like the head of a spear through the body of a fish." He slashed his toe through the circle. "Our river is the outlet. The inlet is on the far south bank of the lake." "How will I find it?" "You will not. unless somebody like Kalulu leads you to it. He lives in the marshes on a floating island of reeds on the lake, near the outlet of the river. How will I find him? By searching diligently and by good fortune, Porto shrugged. Or perhaps he will find you. Then, almost as an afterthought, he added, Kalulu is a shaman of great mystical powers, but he has no legs. When they left the village, Taita gave Porto a double handful of glass beads, and the old man wept. Oh, you have made me rich, and my old age happy. Now I can buy 2 young wives to look after me.